580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3, Urbana.
This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
On Keeping the Faith this afternoon, we're talking with two people who wrote a fascinating chapter in a book out just this year. We're talking with Ed Webb in Dickinson College in Pennsylvania, and we're talking with Mark Wardecker here in the studio in Urbana-Champaign. They're both fans of Doctor Who, and there's a new book out called Doctor Who and Philosophy, Bigger on the Inside, edited by Cortland Lewis and Paula Smithka, as I say, just out this year. And Ed and Mark's chapter is called Should the Daleks Be Exterminated? Now, the Daleks. Let's start with you, Mark. Who are the Daleks, and who's Doctor Who? And for people who have no idea what we're talking about.
Oh, thanks, Steve. Thanks for having me on. The Daleks are the Doctor's worst enemy, and I should probably give you just a little bit of background first.
Please.
The character is not actually called Doctor Who. He's referred to as simply the Doctor.
The Doctor.
Yes, exactly. The one and only, the genuine article. And he is a Time Lord from the planet Gallifrey. And the Time Lords are able to travel in time and space, and they sort of keep an eye on things and make sure nobody's mucking about with the time stream.
Now, before we go any farther, yes. Let's let listeners know that this is an international phenomenon. It's been on for, 700 episodes or something?
Yeah, it actually aired in November 1963, and that's when it first began. And it ran with only one interruption from 1963 to 1989, when the BBC placed it on hiatus. They didn't actually cancel it. They just placed it on hiatus.
So this is a British show on BBC, but...
Yes.
All over the world, right?
And PBS actually ran the episodes in the 70s and 80s in the United States. And originally the format was – it was a serialized format. So you would get a 25-minute episode every Saturday. Huh. And in the UK it was run at Saturday tea time. And it – actually, again, it went off the air in 1989, but it survived in audiobooks and novels and then was resurrected in 2005. And we're now about to begin the sixth season of the show. Actually, that will premiere on April 23rd on the BBC and BBC America, actually.
And the local WILL television is doing what, about a year late?
Actually, yeah. We just noticed today, Ed and I, when we were looking up the web address for the stream of this program, that I guess season 5 will premiere tonight at 6 o'clock on the local PBS affiliate.
So listen on the radio here while we talk about one of these important issues, and then you can see that on our sister station, WILL TV. Ed, were you in England when you first were introduced to the Doctor?
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on. This is going to be a lot of fun, I think. I was born and raised in England, and my first encounter with the Doctor would have been when I was, I'm guessing, about 5 or 6 years old. We actually didn't have a television of our own at that time, but I was visiting a friend of mine down the street, and this program came on. There's this sort of ongoing joke about the Doctor, but it was actually literally true in this case. We ended up hiding behind the sofa because of the scary things we were seeing. But it was fascinating and scary, very compelling television, despite the, zero budget effects. I mean, cardboard sets and all this. But as storytelling, it was very compelling. And so over the years, I tried to keep up with it now and then. And then more recently, particularly when I got to know Mark, when I moved to central Pennsylvania when he was living down here, that helped actually rekindle a lot of my childhood memories. And we would get to talking a lot about what a great series it was and all the different things that that it meant to us.
Now, you talked about how crude it was technically because they had practically no budget when they began back in the 60s. And here they are, we're trying to do this science fiction, fascinating stories. But if you look at a recent one, as I did last night, I saw something from 2009, Planet of the Dead, that was probably illegally online, but I saw that. And, you know, it was really just as up-to-date as any of the fancy movies. It wasn't in 3D, thank God, but it was you know, very technically proficient, I thought. But I thought they did a little flashback to earlier days with one of the scenes where they... It made me think that, oh, they're doing an homage to the way this began, because when they were showing this particular life form on another planet, I thought they began with something that was kind of simple or crude maybe even, and then it got real fancy.
Well, that's rather interesting, because a lot of the people that are involved with the show right now are fans, and were very active in fan culture in the 90s and also in producing a lot of the audio plays and the novels at that time. But I'm not sure about the particular scene you're referring to, but there are a lot of allusions to the earlier show, of course. And there is a lot of continuity there, of course, because we're going on with half a century now. But the original series, they did not have a great deal of money. It was all filmed. There was some location shooting that was done in film, but most of it was done in studio with just videotape. But as Ed said, it was really the writing, because usually they had outstanding science fiction writers yes. Working on the show. And also, they also got first-rate actors, because uh-huh. a lot of the stage actors would come to the BBC and would do, you know, very over-the-top performances for the television shows, particularly yeah. Doctor Who, actually.
And there have been, you were telling me, 11 different main actors for the Doctor.
Yes, 11 official ones. Official. And there are some that are non-canonical, but yes, we are now up to 11, Matt Smith.
Now, Mark, you're a librarian here at the University of Illinois in the reference library. And Ed, you're a political scientist, and you specialize in the Middle East and international studies at Dickinson. How did you discover, when you were both at Dickinson, that you had this interest? Ed, can we hear your memory of that?
You know, I can't even remember. I mean, I think for as long as I've known Mark, I've known this about him. That, you know, that he had this passion for genre fiction in general, for pulp fiction, for Lovecraft, for Conan the Barbarian, for Sherlock Holmes, for all these different things. It was just, that's part of the Mark package. So as long as I've known him, this has been part of it, you know, and so it seemed a natural thing, you know, if we wanted to hang out together, you know, right. it seems the hanging out in front of a Doctor Who episode seems like a natural thing to do.
Now you've lived in America how long yet?
This would be, let me see, this is 11 years now. I came over, this wasn't my first visit, but I moved over here as a permanent resident in 2000.
And Mark was telling me you have two children. Have you infected them with this virus?
I've certainly attempted to, and they understand the vocabulary. You know, there's a rather sinister plastic Dalek sitting in one of the rooms at home, and they're very comfortable with that. They're not not worried about it. They know what a Cyberman is. They know the names of the Doctor's most recent companions and things like this. But they haven't actually watched the series yet. And I think, you know, it's. As I say, my first exposure was when I was 5 or 6, and that's probably a little young. I have friends back in the UK, who one of whom I was talking to quite recently. She has a 6-year-old boy, and he was very keen to watch this, and she knew that I knew a fair bit about it. She said, you know, so is this a good idea or not? And I actually sort of counseled her against it a bit. I said, uh-huh. You know, certain episodes would be fine, but other episodes really do have some quite... troubling material for a child of that age. Once you get up to 11, 12, then you should be able to handle it probably.
And we should let listeners know that we are going to talk about some of those troubling issues because your chapter is really about genocide. The Daleks are this extraordinarily violent, single-focused exterminate. They don't consider themselves murderers, you point out, because this is also technological. But they do want to exterminate all lesser life forms, and that's everybody, right?
It's basically anyone that's not like them, anything yeah. that isn't like them.
And, of course, that reminds us of Nazism.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Sure.
It's absolutely meant to, yes. And actually, that's whenever whenever we first approached it, that was one of the first things that came up. I saw the call for submissions, and at the time, of course, Ed and I were both into the show and had been watching it together. And I just emailed him and I said, "Oh, this is you all over, man. You should definitely contribute something for this." And his idea, and actually I'll turn it over to you in a second, was to focus on one of the Tom Baker, the Fourth Doctor's serials, Genesis of the Daleks, which is an origin story for the Daleks. And I suggested we should probably also look at the very first Dalek serial from 1963, which is actually the second serial the show ever did with the First Doctor, because that also tells the origin story. And I thought we should maybe just take a look at how that changed from the early 60s to the mid 70s, how they, you know, the change in the approach to the two stories. And so we watched a lot of Doctor Who, and I think I'll let Ed say a few things.
Let me reintroduce our guest for those who may have tuned in a bit late today to Keeping the Faith. We're talking about a book called Doctor Who and Philosophy, Bigger on the Inside. We'll get to that in a moment. Edited by Lewis and Smithka, but our two authors today of a chapter on the Daleks and the whole issue of genocide, and really it deals with maybe even capital punishment, I think. Ed Webb in Dickinson College in Pennsylvania, and Mark Wardecker, who was there but now is here at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign. Ed, tell us a little bit about what is this dilemma that you begin your chapter with?
Well, as Mark said, when he first suggested to me that we should write something about Doctor Who and philosophy, some contribution to this volume, I immediately zoomed in on this particular story, which is, as we say, I think, in the chapter, probably one of the darkest stories in the whole long history of Doctor Who. In it, the Doctor is commanded, essentially compelled by other Time Lords. He is himself a Time Lord, but he's a bit of a renegade. He instead of sort of staying at home, you know, and monitoring things, he wanders around the universe having adventures. But the Time Lords intervene and they instruct him. They say, we have seen that the Daleks, this species that he's already encountered several times and in one way or another outwitted or defeated, they say, we foresee that the time will come when they will destroy all life in the universe. So you have to stop this. And so what we're going to do, we're going to take you back to the origin, the moment of the genesis of the Daleks. That's the title of the episode of the serial. We're going to put you back there, and you must stop them. You must destroy them at birth, essentially. And they don't give him a choice about this. He argues. He says, I can't do that. And they say, well, you're going to do it. And they take away his TARDIS, which is his time travel machine. And so he can't escape from this situation.
It looks like a police call-in box.
Right.
Blue.
It appears to be a police call-in box.
Right. But it's bigger on the inside.
Far bigger. Yeah. It's an amazing time and space travel machine. But here he's without it. It's just the Doctor and his amazing knowledge and understanding, you know, and a few nifty tools. But really, it's down to him and his own reason and knowledge. Given this dilemma, given instructions to destroy a species at birth to prevent future horrors. And in this sort of genre of time travel science fiction, this is actually a classic one, right? If someone takes you back in time, points to a baby and says, this baby is going to grow up and do horrible things, be a dictator, kill millions of people, can you then kill that baby? And that's really the situation he finds himself in. Now, interestingly, the Doctor's human companion, who is Sarah Jane, who is one of his amazing, I mean, very well-loved companions over the many he's had, she says, of course you can kill them, right? This isn't a baby we're talking about. This is a murderous, genocidal species that will go off and do countless damage through the universe. Of course you can kill them. But the Doctor doesn't take that line. He knows what they'll do firsthand, but he says, I don't know. I don't have that right to destroy this species at birth. And in the end, and this is maybe a little bit of a cop-out, but in the end, he doesn't have to things pan out in ways that we describe in our chapter, you know, so that he doesn't have to make this decision. But it's clear that for him this is not straightforward. Despite knowing how evil, destructive, dangerous these creatures are, he can't really bring himself to destroy them.
Let me point out how current this type of discussion is. Earlier just today on All Things Considered on PBS, there was a discussion of humanitarian intervention, whether it's in Libya or Bosnia or wherever. And in that history of that movement, they had to make a decision. Would violence ever be acceptable in terms of bringing worse violence to an end? It's a very difficult philosophical and religious question. And, of course, there are groups on the far left, the Quakers, who would say you must always be pacifist. You can't be violent yourself if you're going to be true to your principles. And others who say, would you let genocide occur if you could stop it? This is as current as the morning news.
And this is one of the first times where this degree of complexity is actually introduced in the series, at least with the Daleks. Before, in prior serials, really, their sort of violence and that sort of thing is always their own undoing. There are plots where they basically damage their own power supply in war. And they do themselves in, or they have a plot to tinker with DNA, and the doctor kind of goes in and reverses what they've done so that it backfires on them. But this is one where he actually has to make a conscious choice. And later, and actually at the end of the fourth season, he's presented in the story Journey's End with a similar conundrum, except it's not the doctor. It's a half-human clone of the doctor, and the half-human doctor doesn't hesitate. He wipes them out instantly without even a thought. But and that was the other critical serial we wanted to address when we were working on the chapter. But of course the doctor, the fourth doctor, is much more reflective and much more hesitant to actually make that sort of choice.
Let me throw the phone lines open to listeners who may want to ask a question or make a comment on the issues we're discussing today here on Keeping the Faith with Ed Webb and Mark Wardecker. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host. But this program today, since it began in England and has been very popular throughout the British Great Britain, Canada and Australia and all sorts of places, as well as other English-speaking and maybe other countries as well. I don't know how popular it is in Japan, but we may well, over our podcast, have listeners on their computers around the world today. So we can only give you a free toll-free call if you're in the continental U.S., and that number is 1-800-222-9455. If you're in the Champaign-Urbana listening area, there are several local lines you can access by punching in 333-9455. So if you're in the 217 area code, 333-9455. If it's long distance, 1-800-222-9455. And people in other countries, you'll have to find your own ways to communicate here over the internet with these local numbers. Ed, let me ask you, as a political scientist, these are issues that, of course, are faced around the globe these days. But why was this a particularly good way to deal with these issues for you as a researcher, a writer, a teacher, college professor?
Well, I think there's a broad answer to that and a specific answer. The broad answer is I think that part of our function as academics, those who are in this very privileged situation of being supported in having time to research, to think, to really get into some depth on some issues. I think that, of course, teaching in the most immediate sense in the classroom is utterly at the core of what we do and what we should do and where we should focus our efforts. But I think there's a broader teaching function too, and I think it's important for us to be, to the extent that we have any expertise in anything, to be ready to share that with a broader public. And I think a volume like this, Doctor Who and Philosophy, can be a way of getting getting into some issues, getting to an audience maybe that wouldn't pick up a book of philosophy or political theory or political science, but might pick up this book and say, oh, okay, that's an interesting way to look at this topic. I hadn't thought about it. So I think in general, I'm a big proponent of the idea that academics should be engaged with popular culture, with the media more broadly. Specifically, I think this story, this moment, I mean, it's always stuck with me, both when I saw the serial and then I actually owned, on audio cassette, I owned a recording of this story. And so I used to listen to it a lot. And this moment when the doctor is there with Sarah Jane and asking her, do I have that right? It was such a powerful moment for me and so important to me, I think, as a young person, as a young teen, I guess, was when I really used to listen to this a lot. Thinking, wow, what would I do? Which I think is the start of a lot of sort of ethical discussions and philosophical discussions. What would I do? And I don't know what I would do, but I'm a mere human, not a Time Lord.
So much of morality, it comes down to whether we as humans can imagine what another human is like, what's going on inside them, their feelings, their emotions, their thoughts, their decisions, their quandaries. And it's kind of hard to be a moral actor if you aren't able to do that. And does science fiction help?
I think in this case it does, because it provides a certain layer of abstraction where you can actually you can think about the dilemma without having a sort of visceral human reaction to the threat that's actually presented by this villain. The Daleks throughout the series, and of course they're the perfect ones for the story because they are painted as absolutely ruthless, absolutely evil. There's no gray area with them. They are utterly uncompromising. So in that sense, you can't really it is very hard, hopefully, for the person to relate to them. And it is very hard to relate to the doctor also, because he is a being that is almost godlike and that sort of thing. So it really lets you focus in on the issue itself. And as Ed was saying too, I think part of the importance of genre fiction is in a lot of cases with genre fiction, you do have these sort of extreme environments that within which you can place characters, and it is a very good space in which to deal with these sort of real world issues because you can see them in ways that you wouldn't normally.
It's a real world issue in a different world.
Exactly.
But
exactly.
It's a world that you can enter sort of safely.
Right. And usually that is done for the viewer in this show, that's done via the companion. So, of course, most of the viewers would have immediately sympathized with Sarah Jane. And Harry Sullivan is the other companion, but he's not as vocal at this critical scene, but would see things from their perspective as opposed to the doctor's. So that's.
We have a caller on our toll-free line, line 4. Yes, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Oliver Wendell Holmes said that between two groups of men that want to make inconsistent kinds of worlds, he saw no remedy except force. And it seemed to him that every society rests on the death of men. What is the difference between that and what's happening now?
Ed, any response to that question? Could you hear it all right?
I heard the question. Between that and what is happening now, in what sense? I'm not sure I understood.
I'm afraid we've lost our caller. Maybe he could call back to give you more details. But
I mean, to the general point about force, I mean, interestingly, I think a lot of science fiction involves force. I mean, if you say science fiction to perhaps the ordinary person in the street who's not a big fan, the immediate images that might come to mind are of huge spaceships and laser weapons and robots and all this sort of thing. And of course, there is some of that in Doctor Who, and the Daleks themselves are creatures who use force a lot. The Doctor is not. The Doctor makes it very clear in all his various incarnations that he abhors violence. He doesn't use a gun. He doesn't own a gun. He doesn't own a weapon of any kind, in fact, except his mind. So he's all about the application of reason to problems. And yet he's often put in situations where, of course, he's dealing with those who do not share that, the Daleks being a primary example. They are absolutely ruthless in their use of force. So I think we as humans don't have the luxury of godlike intelligence, nor do we have the luxury of living in a world without force. We have to deal with it. I think what I tried to bring out when I was talking over with Mark, planning out this chapter, is, you know, both the limits of human reason and the ways in which, you know, in practical terms, we can apply it to avoid everything coming down to force.
Yeah, I agree, and I think that is part of the universal appeal of the show, is that it does present a world in which, you know, this particular character can sort everything out just merely by applying his intellect to the problems. It's kind of the same appeal with other other classic fiction, like the Sherlock Holmes stories, that sort of thing. It's a very reassuring notion that, yes, that you can be faced with almost insurmountable problems and yet be able to use reason to work your way through them, and I think that's one of the reasons why the show is so popular. Now, of course, our world is never that ideal, but or very rarely that ideal. But again, I think just the idea of it is very powerful.
The importance of courage, of being willing to face these dilemmas and head on and think about them and try to respond, of course, undergirds all moral action. If for one to make a good decision, it takes that. I noticed in the episode I watched just most recently last night, this Planet of the Dead from 2009, there was this conversation. The doctors and Lady Christine D'Souza were facing this horrible situation in this desert, and they'd been in this flying bus, and it lands there. And anyway, with other passengers, and the doctor says, "The worse it gets, the more I love it." And Lady Christine said, "Me too."
And that's absolutely true. And he usually almost always is able to pull a rabbit out of the hat at the crucial moment. There's a great Fourth Doctor serial, The Horror of Fang Rock, where they're trapped in a lighthouse and there's an alien that's killing off all the people in the lighthouse one by one, and a ship is wrecked off the coast, and a noble, you know, comes in and addresses the doctor and says, "Are you in charge?" And he says, "No, but I'm full of ideas." And it just absolutely sums up the character.
But how realistic is that? And let me get back to our political scientist on that. In comparison with the dilemmas that we face in our real political world, with long-going, you know, tribalisms and hatreds that go back generations and so forth, religious differences, all these things, there isn't always a happy ending when it's not a TV serial.
No, and actually, I mean, To be fair to the writers of the Doctor, various Doctor Who series, it's not always a happy ending for him either, or particularly for his human companions. You know, and definitely it's not a series where no one dies or no one suffers. There's a great deal of suffering, actually. So, I mean, in that sense, the series, you know, speaks to us and
yes,
the world we live in. We're always faced with choices that are not susceptible to pure application of reason, whether it's force, as the caller suggested, or it's the limits of our own human knowledge or human emotions. You know, we can't be like the Doctor. On the other hand, we do have resources that I think the Doctor admires in humans. I mean, when the Doctor Who series started originally, I don't think there was any sort of well-thought-out rationale as to why this immensely powerful alien who can wander the whole universe keeps coming back to Earth, which frankly is rather, you know, unimpressive compared to some of the places he goes. But I think part of the answer to that is that there are things about humans that he really enjoys and admires. For all that we are definitely foolish and potentially murderous, and we have our tribalisms and our xenophobia and our intolerance, but I think some of our qualities he really admires. I think he almost needs them, which is why he so often has human companions. Courage is one that you've mentioned, and some of his companions definitely are primarily associated with courage. I think compassion, though, also is very important in many of the Doctor's companions and in many of the stories. So in the scene we've described, this sort of scene where the human companion is saying, go ahead, destroy the species at birth, and the doctor is the one saying, I don't think I can do that. That's actually reasonably rare. I mean, usually the doctor's companions are quite compassionate people, particularly as they wander the universe and realize how amazing it is and how many different kinds of ways of life there are. It's like Star Trek in that respect, I guess. You know, that it tends to push a sort of tolerant humanism or a tolerant, non-xenophobic type of approach that I think is attractive.
We're about halfway through our Keeping the Faith program this afternoon with our guests Mark Wardecker and Ed Webb. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host. Next week on Keeping the Faith, we'll be talking with Charlene Watts about how we can get beyond partisanship. On April 17, our guest will be Wayne Pittard, who's the director of the Spurlock Museum, the World Heritage Museum here at the University of Illinois. We're going to be talking about some of the specific religious exhibits in the Spurlock Museum, that wonderful resource. Professor Pittard has been in the Department of Religious Studies for years and has been an archaeologist and written widely, and looking forward to that conversation. Those are some of the programs coming ahead on Keeping the Faith. This program has been supported in part over the years by the University YMCA here at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign, and coming up at the Y this Tuesday is a open lecture. Excuse me, it's not a lecture this week, as I misspoke. It's the Edible Book Festival, the sixth annual, held by the College of the Library Science and the University Y. That'll be Tuesday at noon. And so if you'd like to see how various local chefs and cooks have interpreted a book, it's fun to come to, and you can actually participate with a little snack as part of it. So that's at the University YMCA this Tuesday at noon, the 5th of April. And if you would like to get more information about that, call the Y, 217-337-1500. That is a free event. And that's the last of the Know Your University series for this semester. On Friday, there is a lecture, Friday Forum. And on the 8th of April, John Lynn, Distinguished Professor of Military History at Northwestern University, will be the guest of the Friday Forum series, Fear, Anger, and the American Response to Terrorism. This is a free lecture at the Y. If you'd like to reserve a lunch from the Y Eatery, good Thai food, you can call 337-1500, or you can bring your own lunch or simply show up to hear the free lecture. That's noon, University Y, corner of Chalmers and Wright Street. There are buses that'll get you there. Get off at the main library where Mark is a reference librarian, and he'll point you to the Y if you can't find it a half a block away. Or, of course, around noon on Fridays, so many students, maybe faculty, are taking off, so there are often parking spaces right in front of the Y or right beside it. So do give those a shot. April is a very busy month for various interfaith activities. The Crop Walk is April 17. That's Sunday afternoon at 2 o'clock. It'll start at St. Matthew Lutheran Church, raising money for World Hunger. St. Matthew's Lutheran is 2200 Philo Road in Urbana. The Crop Walk, you may want to sponsor a walker, or you may want to walk yourself, or simply go along to show support for this important cause. On April 8 through 10, this next weekend, starting Friday at 4 p.m., at the Independent Media Center in Urbana, that's the old post office, is Books for Prisoner Selling Books, to raise money so they can afford to send all these donated books that they've discovered to prisoners throughout the state of Illinois. We have a huge number of prisoners, and there are libraries in some of the prisons, and this wonderful local group helps send free books to prisoners. So the sale starts Friday at 4, goes till 8 p.m. Saturday goes from 8 in the morning till 5 in the afternoon. Sunday from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. Paperbacks will be 75 cents, hardbacks $1. A few very special, maybe first editions, may cost a bit more than that, but wonderful bargains. And that's this Friday, April 8th through Sunday, April 10th at the Independent Media Center. The Department of Religion at the University of Illinois has its 2011 Thulin Lecture on the Future of Islam and U.S. Muslim World Relations, Thursday, April 14 at 8 p.m. in the Knight Auditorium at Spurlock Museum. John Esposito from Georgetown University will be giving that lecture. These are always wonderful, insightful speakers brought in by the Department of Religion. Well, let's get back to our guest today. Again, the new book out just this year, Doctor Who and Philosophy, Bigger on the Inside, edited by Cortland Lewis, Paula Smithka. We have today on the air with us in the studio Mark Wardecker from the University of Illinois Library and Ed Webb, political scientist from Dickinson College in Pennsylvania. Tell us about Dickinson a bit. You're in Carlisle, Ed.
That's right. We're in Carlisle, which is pretty much in the middle of the state, near Harrisburg, the state capital. Town of about 20,000. Dickinson College is a liberal arts college, a very old, established liberal arts college, founded by Benjamin Rush and John Dickinson, among the founding generation of this country, revolutionary generation. Also, we have as near neighbors here the U.S. Army War College and the Dickinson School of Law, which is at the Penn State Law School. So a concentration of education and learning in a small Pennsylvania town, not far from Gettysburg. Lots to do around here.
How many undergraduate students at Dickinson College?
We have about 2,400, 2,500, something like that.
And you've said you've been there 8 years?
No. This is only my fourth year.
Fourth year there. Okay.
Yes. I came to the States in 2000 to do a PhD at the University of Pennsylvania. So I lived in Philadelphia for a number of years. But I've been teaching here since 2007.
Where did you study before that?
Well, actually, my first degree was from Cambridge University, the other Cambridge, not the Massachusetts one.
We have heard of it.
Yeah, really. It's heard of in all sorts of places. That was obviously a great experience as an undergrad. After that, I didn't go straight on with education. I actually spent nearly 8 years in the British Diplomatic Service.
Where were you stationed?
I had two postings in London, and in between, nearly five wonderful years in Cairo.
What will happen in Egypt in the next month?
I couldn't tell you what's going to happen in Egypt tomorrow, but yeah. I can tell you that I am I'm optimistic about Egypt, and I'm sort of in a secondhand way very proud of Egypt. I see. Young Egyptians, and if we talk about courage, I mean immense courage of their conviction about the possibility of a better society and all that they're doing to achieve that. And I think what we've seen over the past few months in Tunisia, in Egypt, and elsewhere in that region have been quite astonishing events. They do make my job as a political scientist hard to the extent that people expect me to be able to predict what's happening, and I can't. On the other hand, they give me so much fascinating material to think about and talk about, and I don't get much sleep these days.
We're talking about the specific chapter with Ed and Mark. Should the Daleks, these very violent race... Who are out to exterminate everyone they consider less than themselves. You say, let me quote a few sentences from one part of this interesting chapter on should the Daleks be exterminated. You're dealing with the whole issue of should you exterminate those who are determined to exterminate others. You say humans can be monstrous enough to commit genocide. What if gods? It's not difficult to perceive the practically immortal time and space traveling doctor as godlike. His superior vantage point and detachment allow him to make horrible calculations, sometimes sacrificing individuals for the greater good. He sees space-time in a way that's beyond human comprehension, understanding the sweep of history as from the point of view of a being that's outside both space and time, yet who can intervene in and manipulate them. Well, how godlike is the doctor? Mark raised that issue earlier. Mark, do you want to say some more about that?
Well, very much so. Again, he can. You have a being who can travel at any point in time and space. You also one of the characteristics that we haven't gotten to yet. We keep talking about different doctors, and there have been 11 so far. And the reason is that the doctor, whenever he is grievously wounded or if his body is just simply worn out, he can regenerate, where he basically becomes another person but retains the memories of, you know, who he was before. This was actually to facilitate getting new actors into the role. The BBC realized that there would be a certain degree of cognitive dissonance, kind of like when a new Darren shows up on Bewitched or like the many Lionels and the Jeffersons. But it basically – technically – it's been said he can only regenerate 12 times. Now, we'll see. We're about to come up
getting
on that and see whether
that, right.
We're going to test that and see whether they stick to that bit of continuity or not. But for all intents and purposes, I mean, he is immortal as well as being able to, again, travel through any point in space and time. And I think – and we point out, though – that there is at one point a doctor who has a bit of, you know, humanity sort of injected into his DNA in one of the episodes, and he, like we said, exterminates the Daleks, just eliminates them without thinking. The fourth doctor, Tom Baker, as we said, hesitates, and again, that is something that that humans should strive for. I mean, I think one of the things Ed actually puts it very eloquently. There's a section where he talks about Foucault and about the Frankfurt School, where he talks about warning about coarsening of ourselves.
Michael Foucault.
And that sort of thing. Yes, and I think actually at this point I'm going to hand off to Ed to talk more about it, but he has a very eloquent section where he deals with that.
Ed, let me get that to you for that, but before, let me mention the phone numbers again for callers who'd like to ask a question or make a comment. In Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. If it's a long-distance call, 1-800-222-9455. Ed Webb in Pennsylvania, go ahead.
Well, I think what I wanted to do when sort of meditating on this story, and thinking about what lessons we could draw from it, I was drawn also to Jacob Bronowski, who did an amazing television series back in the early 1973, I think it was, The Ascent of Man. And towards right at the end of the series, there's this scene where he is standing in a muddy puddle at Auschwitz. He's standing in an ash pit, essentially. And some of his relatives had died there. And here's this great humanitarian philosopher who has told us this amazing story about human development and human progress, and he's standing there in the ash pit at Auschwitz, and he doesn't say, and this is where it all ends, right? This is where human progress ends, which would be, I think, a very pessimistic place to end. But he says, here's where it could end, right? Here's where all this progress can go if we are not humble, essentially. And he quotes Oliver Cromwell, actually, saying, you know, just entertain the idea you might be wrong, right? And so there's this sort of fundamental idea. As we become more godlike, if you will, in our capabilities, in our knowledge, in our technical proficiency, in how we understand the universe, at least we might perceive ourselves to be becoming that way. But always remember we are not. Always remember we're only human, we're fallible, we get things wrong. Because if you lose that sense, then you can end up with Auschwitz, then you can end up with Daleks, right? Beings who are absolutely convinced, without question, that their way is superior, that they know what is best, and that all other beings, to the extent they are not Dalek-like, are only worth extermination, are worth nothing else. Completely unlike the Doctor. The Doctor loves the diversity of the universe. He has this sense of wonder about him, and he doesn't tell anyone how to be, right? So although he is the one who is godlike, he has this, I think, this essential humility to him, this sort of remembering to be uncertain, I guess. And that, I think, is the most important moral lesson here, that absolute moral certainty is a very dangerous path to go down.
And actually, there is a point in Genesis of the Daleks where their creator, Davros, whenever the Doctor's first whenever he first hears of him, he's telling one of the Khalids, one of Davros's soldiers, that he's from another planet, and the soldier says, "Well, Davros, this super scientist, has said that there is no life anywhere else." And the Doctor says, "Well, obviously he's wrong." And the guard says, "No, he's never wrong." Uh-huh. And the Doctor, of course, says, "Well, even I'm wrong on occasion." And sure. But Davros, who creates the Daleks, who genetically engineers them to be pitiless and merciless, actually does feel that he is absolutely right on every occasion.
We're talking with Ed Webb and Mark Wardecker about the newest book, Doctor Who and Philosophy, Bigger on the Inside, published just this year. On the cover is this police box, this blue police box. Do they still have them in Great Britain?
No. And as a matter of fact, the BBC bought the patent for them at one point so they could continue to make them. No, what happened? The police box comes from – it's actually in the second episode of Doctor Who. They materialize on prehistoric Earth, and they come out of the ship, and the Doctor's confused because it still looks like a police box. Uh-huh. And there's something called a chameleon circuit that's supposed to enable the TARDIS to blend in with its surroundings, but it's broken. So it always looks like a blue police call box, and it adds to sort of the quirky nature of the show, I mean, which, of course, came out around the same time as the Avengers and that sort of thing.
And tell us what a TARDIS actually can do.
Well, TARDIS is actually short for time and relative dimensions in space, and it's – again, it is a machine that allows the Doctor to dematerialize and then rematerialize at any point in time and space. Okay. It looks like a police box on the outside. However, on the inside, there is a pocket dimension. So it is actually infinitely large on the inside. It's even been implied on a few shows that it is actually sentient, that they're grown and not made. Oh. But again, it is his primary means of transportation. And actually in Genesis, that's one of the problems because he doesn't have access to it and can't get away at a critical time.
Could these shows have been made for commercial television? Or is there something special about the BBC and public TV that enables them to have shows that are so dark in some cases and deal with such philosophic issues? I mean, how would you sell this to an advertiser? I mean, it's...
Well, the BBC program, that's interesting because actually that kind of quirky program, when you think back to the mid-60s, Doctor Who, but think about what else was on TV at that time. You had The Avengers, which is a rather quirky and odd show. The Wild Wild West, which is a very eccentric show. The Prisoner, which is a very deep, very dark philosophical program. These shows coming from both the UK and from the US. So I think in some ways – Doctor Who is a product of its time, and it probably did have more freedom because it ran, on a publicly funded station. But I mean, it is a huge commercial success, and it was even then. So I'm not sure if that's really part of it. Ed, what do you think?
Yeah, I think probably the one thing that wouldn't have happened is the amazing resources of the BBC Radiophonic Workshop, which is responsible for that. Some of the bizarre sound effects and the theme tune, which is still absolutely cult. You know, that was the sort of thing that a public broadcaster could invest in that maybe would not have been possible.
So this is the electronic music, which very, you know, for the 60s was just quite strange to be hearing on television.
It was an utterly radical. I mean, this was, you know, I think quite important in introducing the concept of electronic music to a broad audience. So that, I think, is probably unique to what a public broadcaster could do. But I think in terms, as Mark says, I think there was a lot going on in the 60s in terms of experimenting with the medium and pushing things. I think probably what allowed a show like The Prisoner, for example, to explore some quite deep territory in psychology and philosophy and politics was that it was a genre show, right? Here's a spy show, or the Doctor Who stuff is, you know, this is a science fiction show, right? I think you can get away with more in those circumstances in terms of putting doing thought experiments in popular culture.
When you were growing up in Great Britain and England and watching these shows, like when you're an undergraduate at Cambridge, was there any response from the various religious traditions to the show, to the issues raised in the show?
I can't say I was aware of them. That doesn't mean that there was
Mary Whitehouse's Decency Crusade.
Right, there was some of that. Mary Whitehouse, famous or infamous, depending how you look at it, figure in British television history, particularly television history, a campaigner for what she saw as decency. So a very, very strong advocate of censorship in the interests of protecting children, protecting family values and things like this. And she definitely raised concerns about that it was too frightening for children at the time it was broadcast and things like this. I don't know, I don't recall, though, religious engagement with the themes back then. I suspect probably there's more of that going on now, and because I think the current series, for all that we talk about this particular story from the 1970s and this very early story from the 60s, I think the seasons we've had since 2005 with people like Russell Davis and Stephen Moffat in charge, not only have they had bigger budgets to play with, and therefore the effects, etc., streets ahead of where they were. But I think they've had a lot of freedom to really push some of the issues further and develop the character in interesting directions. I just saw actually on Twitter one of my students is reacting, he's listening to the show online, and points out that on this question of humility, the version of the Doctor played by David Tennant towards the end of his tenure lacked humility. Actually, what happens, though, is that that's his undoing in many respects. You see a classic story of hubris and nemesis when the Doctor starts to act more godlike in the sense of, you know, maybe a classic Greek god, you know, is sort of emerging, messing around with humans, right, changing their lives in ways that don't respect the sort of the course of history. And it goes badly for that version of the Doctor. So I think that's I would recommend anyone who doesn't know the series actually to start with the more recent stories that have been put out there since 2005, and then delve into the back history where they'll find the charm of the cardboard sets and the cheesy effects, but they'll also find some very interesting stories as well.
How might listeners who are new to the Doctor and the Doctor Who series? You say start with some of the more recent ones, but are they available on video stores?
Sure. The episodes, I think, for 2005 to the present are all available via Netflix. through other means too. If you just do video searches online, you can probably find them as well. You can rent the DVDs. The BBC does a beautiful job with their DVD sets, and also with the classic series as well. They've issued a great deal of those serials on DVD with a lot of really great extra features and are quite beautiful. You can also find a lot of the classic episodes online though as
and
well.
And probably for local listeners, that we have a wonderful video store here. That's Rentertainment that sort of specializes in international things. Oh, okay. I'm sure they have all these from Great Britain.
Right. And so, like we said, the fifth new season is going to be airing tonight on WILL. So.
WILL TV at 6 p.m. Central Time. We have another caller waiting on line number one. Yes, you're on Keeping the Faith. Go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to make one addition to the list of wonderful things that are going on next weekend.
Sure. Go ahead.
There's going to be a contra dance with Cakewalk and a young person's band playing for it at the Friends Meeting House from 7 to 9 p.m. on Saturday, April 9th. And it's going to have a chocolate fountain, a dessert bar, and it's free will donation. And the money goes toward our AIDS orphan school fees and toward our emergency fund, which tries to pick up people that fall through the cracks elsewhere.
And that's at the Friends Meeting House in Urbana, Illinois, on East Main Street in Urbana.
1904 East Main.
Thank you very much. Appreciate this.
Thank you.
Sharing that information. Ed, we're down to our last just couple minutes, really. Any last comments on this issue of moral decisions about genocide?
Well, I don't think this is an issue that's ever going to be readily amenable to easy discussion.
Of course.
Genocide is abhorrent, and I think, you know, talking about current events, the emerging doctrine in the United Nations of the right to the responsibility to protect that has come out of, you know, events such as the horrible massacres in Rwanda in the mid 90s.
Yes.
I think we're seeing hopeful signs, really, that the international community, with the United States obviously playing a very significant role in this, is beginning to take seriously the Genocide Convention, which came out of the Second World War and which imposed on its signatories and all states party to it, you know, the responsibility to make sure this doesn't happen again. But it's easier said than done. I'm just, as with, you know, the specific case of Egypt and where things are going there, I'm cautiously optimistic that we're seeing that we're moving in a good direction in preventing future genocides. But I don't think we're yet at a place where we can say this is not going to happen again.
With that cautionary warning, I want to thank our guests for being on Keeping the Faith tonight. Mark Wardecker, reference librarian here at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign, and Ed Webb, professor of political science and international studies, Middle Eastern studies at Dickinson College in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. I'm Steve Shoemaker, usual host for these Keeping the Faith programs. Next week I'll be talking with Charlene Watts about getting beyond partisanship. And the following week, April 17, with Professor Wayne Pittard, director of the Spurlock Museum, about religious things that can be seen there in that World Heritage Museum. Thanks for listening to Keeping the Faith.
You've been listening to Keeping the Faith, a production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
WILL is your source for full-service news and information. We've aired NPR's award-winning news programs for the past 40 years and provided our own local and regional news coverage. We're also proud to have aired Focus, our locally hosted talk show, for the past 30 years. Our Spring Pledge Drive begins Saturday. We're encouraging listeners who are committed to this type of service to call in their pledge of financial support or give online now at willpledge.org.
Hi, I'm Jim Fleming, host of To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI. Looking for something to talk about at your next party or around the water cooler on Monday morning? Check in on To the Best of Our Knowledge each week. Science and religion, rethinking animal intelligence, maybe how memory works. Fascinating discussion on To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Sunday evening from 7 to 9 on AM 580. This is Illinois Public Media.